The Burgerkrieg Productions 15 Minutes of Fame podcast features Jimmy of the Canadian punk rock band The Vapids. Here's their song Box Shaped Heart.
Very cool. It is the Burger Creek Productions 15 Minutes of Fame podcast, season three. I have somebody who has decided to come back and chat with me again. I'm very excited. I have Jimmy from the Vapids. Jimmy, welcome. Welcome back, I guess, as it were.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Awesome.
And did I mention that it was really, really fucking hot?
My skin is sweating in spots I didn't think could actually produce sweat. So I'm right there with you. Now, Jimmy, yeah. your latest solo album, Killmatic, it was released in June of 2021 by all accounts. It's been floating around for some time. Spill the beans. What has the reception been like for your latest solo record?
Well, it's been pretty good. Get lots of nice things people have been saying. I find the internet nowadays, as opposed to pre-internet, is that you don't really get bad reviews anymore. I found back in the zine days, and where you would actually have to send a album somewhere, and they didn't have to talk to you, and if they thought that it sucked, you just got a bad review because you would never know who the person was and probably never see them again. I find now you don't read a lot of bad reviews anymore. But nonetheless, the talk has been pretty good, and I'm overtly proud with the way it turned out, and I'm happy to hear that people are enjoying it.
Excellent. I know.
What I've about heard. You? Did you get your copy?
I did not get my bundle yet. I'm still awaiting.
What?
I'm still awaiting that arrival.
It's melting in your mailbox
right now. It's the thing is too, the mail carriers in our neck of the woods are typically very good. They put things indoors. We have I live in an apartment complex, so we have like a nice little stairwell. And so I will double check following this interview, but I did not get the buzzer on the door that I normally get when items are delivered. So hopefully it's not melting downstairs, but fingers crossed.
Okay. Well, it's probably not going to be too much longer. I think, from here to the States is usually like a max about a week. So
right.
Maybe it's been a week.
It's been about that. Yeah, I believe so at this point. So I'm very excited for that arrival. I've spent some time with it digitally, and I do have a question for you later on in the interview about a specific track. But I wanted to know, even though you're a seasoned, rock and roll musician, punk rock veteran, are there still any parts of the recording process that you dread?
Do I dread recording processes? Well, the mix is always a tough one it's like when you get the very first mix, you think that it's fine. And then the person that's mixing it says, no, this is not the final version at all. This is just a rough mix. And, it's always a rough mix until it gets submitted for production. It sounded pretty good to me after the first couple days. And I was happy with it. And if I listened to that, those early mixes now, I can most definitely say that those were rough mixes. Mm-hmm. My drummer Al, that recorded the whole thing and mixed it, I was kind of not really giving him the gears, but I think I said that it sounded perfect about 10 rough mixes ago. but he really pulled out all the stops, and the final version is exactly what I was thinking. Recording, right when you hear it back for the first time, I kind of liked it. Mm-hmm. And but the mixing process is kind of tough, especially when someone else is mixing it. Mm-hmm. Usually with me, I just do everything super fast. So I could go down and record a song, and I would mix it, and I would think it sounds fine. And the next day I'm posting it somewhere, and years later I think, geez, what if I had just spent an extra couple hours on that? I think the recording process, I like it a lot. And I know that Al that I mentioned, he's really into doing it. He doesn't do it for a lot of people. It's kind of a home studio, and I know that he enjoys that process too. So I kind of leave it to him. He's probably the only person that I would do that with at this point. And I've known him for a long time. For me recording, and I record a lot. I record more. I record other people probably more than I record myself. And sometimes when the band leaves and I'm there by myself, I know I'm pretty limited in my resources. I don't record with a computer or, a whole bunch of fancy gear. And, there's only so many things that I can do with mixing. And I tend to just kind of record it the proper way and hopes that it, once it's mixed, it sounds like it was recorded. I don't ever try to manipulate things or make things different. Like if your guitar sounds like shit through your amp, it's probably going to sound like shit in the final mix. That's just the way that goes. If you hit your snare drum like a baby, it's going to sound like you're hitting your snare drum like a baby. Mm-hmm. With me. And I mean, a lot of bands could hit their drums like a baby and it comes back sounding like, high voltage or something.
Right.
That's not the way that I record. Now for Killmatic, it's pretty much what it is. It was made in a little room, and we didn't utilize any sort of, fake amplifiers or drum triggers or nothing. We just played it hard and loud and hit the drums hard and had the amps turned up, and that's the way it turned out, and I'm still pretty happy with it even after 6 months.
that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we're talking about the recording process, because this is a fantastic segue into my next question. And it's kind of a long-winded one, so buckle up. Now, I ended up with some Matt Ellis related projects on CD, the Mystic self-titled, a couple Flesh Rag albums. And I see that you're credited as tracking many of these songs, recording essentially. Now, Matt writes on Bandcamp regarding the Harbor Rats demo album that you, quote, always thought redlining the recordings was a good idea, end quote. Now, are there any specific recording sessions when you were working with Matt and his various projects, any specific sessions that stick out to your mind, stick out in your mind as being memorable, either in a good way or a bad way?
Well, I listened to Matt's Burger Creek interview just yesterday.
Oh, nice.
And it was very pleasurable to hear him talk. I don't speak to him very often. Now, pleasurable, I mean, we always just didn't think about anything. We just, whenever we record, I mean, you look at the Harbor Rats, that's pretty much the Vapids. I mean, it's the Vapids drummer, it's Matt on bass, it's me on guitar and vocals. But when we recorded that stuff, it was literally put the mic on the drums, literally like two of them. Put the mic on the guitar amp and just play it. And if you didn't screw up, then it was done. And, but a lot of that stuff I mean, that Harbor Rat stuff was recorded quite some time ago. And did I know what I was doing? Yes. Did I purposely redline all that stuff? Absolutely. Like, I knew that if I didn't do that, I knew what it would sound like. But when I imagined it being finished, I purposely recorded it overtly loud because that's what I had envisioned. I mean, it's not all, I mean, there's a lot of Harbor Rat songs. I think that thing that's on Bandcamp of the Harbor Rats, there's like 30 songs on there. They're probably only recorded in twos or threes. So every song is going to sound a little bit different, but I was definitely in a mind frame to just, you know, make it redline. Mm-hmm. Don't like disregard all of the rules of recording and, you know, just kind of, as long as you love it at the moment when you play it back, then that's just what it was. And, you know, like a lot of that stuff was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun recording it. And, you know, Matt archived all that stuff because none of those songs were ever online anywhere. He was putting together these snippets of bands that he had doing some charity donations through Bandcamp. And he was like, I'm going to put on this Harbor Rats demo. And we actually released like a demo CD. You know, we made covers. We sold them at our few little shows that we played. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, I have every session we ever did. I still have them all. And a lot of them I had to remix. A lot of them were just, you know, the files that I had weren't even labeled. So I didn't even know the names of the songs half the time. And I was like, oh, I remember that song. It was called this. And, you know, and he took all of those songs and put them on Bandcamp. And I was like, this is so awesome to hear all this stuff because it's literally like 15 years old, some of it. So he did a great job on that. And he should be proud of all those late nights.
Well, they sound, I mean, the items that he sent me, and again, it was that Mystics self-titled and then the two of the Flesh Rag releases, and they sound great. Yeah. They sound great, man. I mean,
The Mystics, I used to have a studio in a barn. I mean, I have a studio in my house now, but I used to live on a farm, and I had a studio in a barn for 3 or 4 years. I recorded a lot of records out there for a lot of bands. And that Mystics was recorded in the barn, but in the big part of the barn. So giant, like the biggest, like I think the Mystics 7-inch, the vocals were recorded in the silo, an empty barn silo. And like at night, we had to drop a lamp on an extension cord. We dropped the lamp to the bottom of the silo. And then we had to snake a bunch of mic cables down into the silo and shine like a flashlight on them so they could see. And, you know, cause there's a female vocalist as well as Matt. And they did those vocals down probably at midnight in a bottom of the silo with like just gunk, like probably dead animals, dead birds. And, you know, that 7-inch is raw as crap, but it's really good. I mean, they only did that one 7-inch and then one other demo. And that other demo was recorded in a totally different studio in a totally different town. But I like it. I mean, it's raw. It's pushed. All the levels are pushed, but it's great. Is there one specific that I like a lot? It's this band called the TV Freaks. From Hamilton, all those guys are connected with Matt from Rock Reducers, Flesh Rag, Anxious Pleaser. It's all of those guys. And they recorded a 7-inch in my barn, and it's called Leeches, but the band is called TV Freaks. I think to this day, that is probably my favorite overblown recording that exists. That 7-inch just rules. And it was super, you know, just cranked right out, and but it's mixed well, so that's my favorite, most memorable.
So whose idea was it to record vocals in a silo? Because that's pretty ingenious. Talk that about was, like reverb.
Well, they wanted reverb, but I don't have any outboard gear for reverb. I don't, you know, I don't have a computer. You just click on a thing that says add
right
silo. So they wanted that to sound like that. So I was like, well, we can just do it in the silo, because you stick your head in the little feed hole on the silo, and you scream, and it's like, you know, that's about as natural of a reverb as you can get.
That's crazy. So the rest, yeah. So you said the rest of the bands specific to that session, that was recorded in like the hayloft mount, if you will, like the largest part of the barn itself, right?
The barn is massive, and we literally set everything up right in the middle of the barn, and pretty much just press record on the old 8-track, and that was it.
I mean, that's.
And, I mean, there's some Flesh Rag stuff too that was recorded there. I believe. I don't know what he sent you. As for Flesh Rag, I only recorded all the early like Summer of Bummer demos. I mean, I think I play on them too. But the Flesh Rag album that I recorded was the first 12-inch, which was recorded live on off the floor in Matt's living room where he still lives. And there's a 7-inch that I did, the Stay Away 7-inch. And I think that was recorded in the same place, like literally in his apartment, full volume.
Were there any issues like recording in the barn? Like, and that's one thing I will say, like, you know, did you run into like electrical issues? Like, you know,
God, yeah. I had to sprinkle cayenne pepper everywhere, mothballs everywhere. There's like, oh yeah. Like everything's eaten by mice, dead mice in the kick drum,
nice.
Like grill cloth being eaten. And I'm sure because I still have the same gear and I still use the same gear. I'm sure it's, the fact that it's, deteriorating as it is now probably stems a lot from being in that barn all summer, all winter.
Oh, wow.
Left it all out there. Yeah.
Well, kudos to that equipment that you're still holding on to that's still working to this day, because, you know, the recordings sound fantastic. So there's something to be said for that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's pretty punk, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now, speaking of being pretty punk, you opened a record store, Raining Sound Records, in Hamilton, I believe circa 2004, when you were 31 years old, right? No phone, no computer, no cash register, no rules. Now, was owning a business at 31 years old, being a 31-year-old punk rocker, was it a breeze, or did you have a number of hard lessons to learn in the first year that you were open?
Well, you know, my father told me I was 29, and I'd been playing in my band for 10 years already. He said, you know, if you're really going to do this, it's already been 10 years, so it's not working out for you. So why don't you try something different? And, you know, I had been working a good job at the same place for probably more than that. And he goes, I don't know, you got to try something. If the band's not working out, and I mean, at this point, the band's kind of working out, but it didn't seem to be taking off as a full-time job. So he convinced me to try something else, not necessarily opening up a record store with zero experience in retail or business management whatsoever. And you know what? I just quit my job and I went and did it. And I took all the records in my collection. I got a $10,000 loan. I found a couple distributors, and I filled this little time. Oh, and I went and found a really cheap place in an amazing location in Hamilton. And the rent was only $600. And the landlord didn't care what the hell I did. He's like, you make sure that your check, you know, cause this is check. This is ain't no e-transfer by month. And I just went with it. I mean, it was easy at first. It was kind of fun. You know, when the doors opened, I had a ton of stuff in there. And then I realized, well, the more people that come in, because it was pretty popular when it opened. And I said, oh, my shit. I just sold 300 records. I need to restock I need to restock the store or people are going to come back and not have anything to buy. Mm-hmm. So then I was like, oh shit, I have to get some more money somehow. So, you know, I started using my credit card and, you know, just buying, you know, and I tried to skip all of the legitimate distributors and just go direct with all these labels. So I would call up Crypt Records, which is by that time we're like in Jersey. And I would just call them up and say, I have a store and I want to stock my store, you know, and but Tim Warren, classic Tim Warren, was like, I can do that. I can send you everything for cheap. So all of a sudden I was like, I had my whole store was full of Crypt Records releases and for cheap. And it was awesome. And then I just did that with every label. I did that with like Norton Records. I started getting all the old, you know, garage rock reissues. And I just stayed out of the paying tax. I stayed out of, doing everything the way you're supposed to. But it maintained itself. And, when people brought in used records, I gave them a good amount of money for them and they would keep bringing me in all this stuff. So I was buying all this used stuff and, you know, flipping it for a fair price. And, it seemed to maintain itself. And, I also sold beer all day, every day. So I would get all these people that would just come in to have beer.
That's so awesome.
And you always had to buy two. You couldn't just buy one. You had to buy two for $5. And they were always there, always on ice. So, you know, I got all these people just hanging around, hopefully buying records. Not all of them did. And, you know, I had live gigs there almost every week. On a Friday or a Saturday, I would, you know, cram probably 60 people in there. And we'd have gigs and they'd be $3. And I would sell 10 cases of beer. And, you know, that practically paid the rent. And, yeah, I mean, it was fun, but, you know, I'm not stupid. So I kind of, when the time came to close it up and get back to, real life, I just snapped my fingers and shut the door and, took all the records home.
And that was that.
That was the end of Raining Sound. Yeah.
So
but it was fun for sure.
So when you had mentioned, you know, people would bring in, you were not only getting reissues, people were bringing in used items. Were there any albums that surprised you that sold really well? And were there bands that surprised you that didn't sell as well as you thought they would?
We're talking almost 20 years, 18 years ago. When I left the store and brought all the records home, there was stuff there that never sold that I couldn't believe it. Like all of the, remember when I say I didn't get from legitimate distributors, mm-hmm. I did, just not very often. So from the legitimate distributors, I would get some like, you know, popular albums, like all of the Donna stuff was still being sold through Canadian distributors. And when I left, I had all these sealed copies of all these Donna's records. And I mean, the Donna's are top five for me. I love the band, still do. And I came home with all these sealed copies that of records that were already 7-8 years old that nobody bought. Nobody ever bought the Dictators album. So I came home with all these sealed Dictators albums. I'm like, what? Who's buying the Dictators album? You know, you got to buy all the Dictators albums. The big thing there was a lot of hardcore. Hamilton had quite a scene for, Short and Fast. And that stuff sold a lot. And you remember the label Gearhead?
Who, what are some of the bands that would have been on there?
Oh, like the Hives.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like early Hives. So much. Anyways, I used to get that stuff for so cheap. Like LPs were $5. And I was like, wow, all this stuff is really good. It's only $5 to buy, the wholesale. So, you know, you go and spend $500 and then all of a sudden you have five copies of 20 different Gearhead Records releases, and they sold all right when they came. And then I restocked them, and then nobody bought them. And I mean, all that stuff is really good. That was a great, great label in the early 2000s. I mean, I sold like bootleg t-shirts. I mean, you can't just rely. Like, I don't think I ever stocked a new sealed Ramones record ever, because they weren't all being reissued then.
I mean, at that there was the Rhino reissues, right? 05, 06, somewhere around there. 08, maybe?
Yeah, well, that's after.
Yeah.
That's after the store. So it was like, I was just selling a lot of used stuff. People would bring in their entire collection of Ramones. At this time, Ramones records were worth $10
mm-hmm.
for a used record. I mean, now you're talking four times that for an old copy. You just rely on like a certain few or a certain dozen like customers that are like willing to buy almost anything that you recommend. Usually they're really young or they're, you know, a little bit old, and you say, hey, have you heard this? Have you heard that? And they just buy it. If I said it was good and the price was good, then they'd end up buying it. And then they walk out and I was like, fuck yeah, I'm going to buy some more of that stuff. And then nobody ends up buying it after that.
Jeez. Well, it sounds
you
like...
You know what? The problem with Raining Sound was that the it was just a couple of years too soon. CDs were still way popular then. And vinyl had not quite made a comeback like it did a few years later. Mm. And, I don't regret opening up in that time, but that had I sold just as many CDs as I did records. And, it's part of my past. It was fun. And, I just had to make the proper choice to get back to work at a regular job.
Is it true that Dee Dee Ramone referred to the Vapids as, quote, one of the all-time best punk bands ever in his biography?
He did.
Okay.
Now, I don't know why. I don't know why he did that, but he definitely did. I have the book. It's a widely available book. And I was just as surprised as anybody about that.
Now, which one is it? Is it the Poison Heart one that he did? Because I know he had a couple of them.
It's The Legend of a Rock Star.
Interesting. That is...
You know that one? He's on the cover with his hands up.
Yep. That's random.
Yeah.
That is extremely random. And you have no idea how this happened?
Well, I do. I spent some time with him before the record store. Probably 2001. Do you already know the story?
I don't.
You don't know the story?
No. And that's why I want you to dig in a little bit, because I don't know this story.
Huh. Okay. Well, I'll try to make it short. I won't get into too many details, but 2001, Vapids were playing a lot. We were playing some bigger shows by this time. Charm School Dropouts wasn't released, but it was recorded.
Okay.
And we had lined up a label deal with EMI,
EMI,
a label called Other People's Music, who had just started releasing CDs. A label from Toronto, and they had released a bunch of different archival punk albums, but had just released Dee Dee Ramone's Hop Around album.
Okay.
And we had played with the Remains a few times leading up to that release. And the cover of that album is the photographs by me, and the guitar that he's playing is actually my guitar as well. And from Toronto, it's a, uh, it's it's an FG that he's playing on there. So without giving too many details, after that initial gig, I was called to by the management of Dee Dee to drive them on a tour for the Remains tour. So Marky, Barbara, Dee Dee wanted to come to Canada for a week. And they called me and they said, do you want to be the driver? And I said, yes, I'll absolutely be their driver. So they gave me the itinerary, pick them up from the airport. Here are all their shows. You need to lend them gear. So, of course, I'm lending them all their gear. So all sorts of stuff happens. It's well documented. I will send you a link to the entire story sometime. But when they went home, Dee Dee stayed in contact with me for a year or so. This is leading up to his death. And he wanted me to send him pot seeds, marijuana seeds, so he could grow the pot in L.A. because L.A. pot was too expensive. So what I did was I took a CD of Charm School Dropouts, a unreleased but a CD version, and I put some pot seeds in the spine of the CD, and I mailed it to him, and he got the CD, and he said, this album is incredible. This is your band? And I was like, yeah, because obviously he didn't watch our shows or anything. So he said, you should... Who do you have to release this? And I said, well, you know, we don't. And he goes, well, I'm going to hook you up with this EMI deal and this label, Other People's Music, that just put out my album. I said, hell yes. So for the next 6 months, we worked out a deal with this label, and everything is going fine, and all the artwork is done. Says EMI on, distributed by EMI on the back, all this shit for Charm School Dropouts. And then one day, because we're talking quite a bit at this point, he calls me and says, do not put your album out with this guy. He's a Nazi, German Nazi. He's the worst. He's just screwed me out of all this money. And I believed him. And so we pulled the album from the label and ended up releasing it ourselves, which was probably a good thing. So that's the story about him hearing Charm School Dropouts when it was unreleased, and he really liked it, and he was interested. He's like, do you guys have a manager? I'm like, hell no. He's like, do you guys have a booking agent in the States? I said, fuck no. We don't have any of that stuff. He goes, how does your band exist? Who does this? And I was like, well, we just do everything ourselves. And he was, you know, kind of flabbergasted by that kind of thing. I mean... And he's like, do you have a job? And I was like, yeah, I have a job. Of course I have a job. He's like, I never had a job. I was like, well, your job is being Dee Dee Ramone. That's
yeah,
a
right.
Full-time job. Right? So, you know, so that, and you know what? And then a year later he died. So, that was kind of sad. And, I still talk to, Barbara really, really frequently. And she's doing fine. And she sent me a picture of the CD that I sent with the pot seeds in it. Probably a month ago, she was moving. And she found a box of CDs. And I guess ours was on the top. And she took a picture. And she sent me the picture. And she says, I know what this CD is.
That's
I was like, yeah,
funny.
That's the one with the pot seeds in it. I said, you better check. Fine. Maybe you didn't get them all.
How's
that for a story?
It was a CD. I really enjoyed that story a lot. That was fucking awesome. Holy shit.
I will send you a link to, I have it somewhere. It's much more elaborate than that and a lot more, details, but you know,
I gotta hear that. So please send that to me when you can. That would be wonderful.
I have it. I know where it is.
Okay. Now, this is kind of the moment I'll let you, plug anything. If you want to tell individuals who are listening where they can get copies of Killmatic or any other recordings, I know right now that you also have the 1997 repress, or I guess for the first time on vinyl, Drink Beer. Anything you want to plug, social media pages, all that great stuff, let people know?
Well, we'll start with Drink Beer. Drink Beer is released yesterday or the day before, officially, is first time on vinyl from an Italian label called Radiation. Well, the label called Hey Suburbia, but mainly distributed by Radiation Reissues. So that's out and about. I don't have any more copies left. Killmatic came out a month or so ago. Got lots of those left. It's streaming only on Bandcamp. I'll put it on Spotify or whatever whenever the record gets sold out. So that might be a while still. It's available in the States. It's available in Europe. Check my Instagram. There's all sorts of links on there to where. What else is coming up? The Matt Ellis record rules. It's like Ramon's core personified,
awesome.
Perfected. That's out there. It's almost sold out. I think they're going to repress it. Another thing is the Lorenas, which is my wife's band from 2004 to 2009. She was in a all-girl punk rock band called the Lorenas, and that album from 2005 is coming out in December on Mom's Basement, Surf and Kai. That's pretty exciting. What else is coming out? New School Damage, which are some really good friends of mine from Toronto. Been trying to pump that for them. It rules. Great band. Nothing else is going on here. Just hiding from the heat.
Trying to.
Do I have anything else coming out? Nothing. No, that's pretty much it for me. Buy Killmatic. Even if you don't like punk, you probably would be... you probably might enjoy it anyway.
Well, digitally,
right?
It is. I would agree. Digitally, again, I'm still waiting on hopefully the Not Melted record to be delivered circa U.S. Freight or Postal, whenever that comes in. But I agree, the album's fucking killer. In particular, I really like the song Total Commitment. And it just, you know, it clocks in. It's a fucking scorching 1 minute and 26 seconds, complete with like some fantastic little quick guitar melody leads. And the lyrics in particular, don't get in my way, there's going to be hell to pay. Now, personally, from the outside, if one were to look at your music career thus far, right, I would almost say that Total Commitment could define your career. Right, you've opened a record label, you've recorded all different types of bands, you've been active in the scene, you've helped musicians along the way. Now, in your opinion, what personal qualities do you possess, do you believe that you possess, that have helped push you along your musical career?
Ooh, that's a big one. Well, let me tell you about Total Commitment. Total Commitment is a song about a little thing, that a little problem that I possess, that I have to do everything super fast or I get bored of it. So if I have to do the laundry, I'm doing 15 loads of laundry. If I have to build a shed in my backyard, get the hell out of my way, I'm building this shed, whether it's right or whether it's wrong or whether it's crooked or the roof has a hole in it, by the end of the day, the shed is going to get built. It's a commitment to it's like a commitment to myself, no matter good or bad. If I'm going to cut the grass, you better look out, because I'm going to, like, speed of light, I'm going to cut my grass. So and you better get out of my way or I'm going to run you over with my lawnmower kind of thing. So it's probably the less serious of a song on that entire album is Total Commitment. is there a quality to me that I know of? I usually speak my mind. If I think someone's band sucks, I usually tell them that their band sucks. Even if I am great friends with them, I'd probably, you know, they would have to bring it up. Like, do you think my band is good? And I would probably tell them no if I didn't. So I guess that's kind of a quality. I kind of tell it like it is. Does that sound like I'm an asshole? maybe that's another quality. Is a lot of people think I'm an asshole, but I'm just really being honest. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you can't get over that, then I mean, you know, ask somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to end it here because, you know, I'm really the nicest guy. And I really am. Yeah. I mean, you know, I live a pretty quiet life out here. And when I get mixed up with people and they want to know shit, I tell them the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody sucks. But but if you ask me, if you ask the question, if you did a little game, like you did with Jeff there, you said, do you like the Bad Brains or do you like Bad Religion? I would tell you. I would tell you which one I like.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell you why I didn't like the other one.
There'd be explicit details as to why you felt that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they're like both great bands, but I prefer Bad Religion.
Mm.
Actually, hugely influential in my early childhood. Getting into punk, probably even one of the first, like before the Ramones, for sure. When I was a young lad, listening to that band sort of changed a lot of how I felt about, you know, music or even like politics and stuff like that, which we won't get into that. But,
well,
I mean, I love Bad Religion. I don't know about you.
I fucking love Bad Religion. Suffer is one of my favorites just in general. It's
a powerful
fucking album. Now what particularly about Bad Religion struck you? What about the band itself? From a musical perspective, I know you mentioned like it helped shape politics and all that stuff, but like what about the band?
Yeah. Probably not the politics as much as you know, their songs were like perfect. Like they were structured perfect. They were all go, no slow kind of thing. It was like one after the other. They were all short. You know, when you're listening to like bands that are kind of, you can't, you know, like the Misfits, like I love the Misfits to death, but you know, you never knew what the lyrics were. And you know, a lot of hardcore bands, you kind of thought that you knew what they were, but you didn't. And then Bad Religion came out and everything is just so clear and on the table. I mean, the lyrics are, they're printed. They're clear as day. The songs are fast and the albums are so cohesive one after the other. Like, I mean, especially that little stretch there in the late 80s, it was like game changer. I saw Bad Religion in 1990 with Green Day, and I didn't even know who Green Day was. And I mean, they were awesome, but when we went to the show on that tour, we were watching Green Day going, huh, this band's pretty good, right? Mm-hmm. And then watching Bad Religion and then buying the Green Day tape and then taking it home. And then, you know, that's a whole other thing. But like really, really early on, just the art of punk rock songwriting, it was so perfect. Like they're just perfectly played,
mm-hmm.
and I really took to that band a lot.
Yeah, there's
and Suffer is my favorite too.
It's absolutely perfect. I think for me, what really blew me away too is how they were able to make things so full, especially vocally. You know how they're big on like the Bad Religion chorus, you know, just it's Greg's voice layered a bunch of times, right? So it's like, I like that. I love that. It's not orchestral, but almost like faux fucking church choir shit. Just the woes and the ahs,
yeah,
and all that. It's crazy. It's crazy. It's so...
Well, you know, it's perfect. And, you know, there's a thing, you know, everyone makes fun of Greg because when he sings, he throws his hands up. You know how he does it?
I know exactly
like,
what you're talking
he's
about.
He's like an orchestra conductor. He's like being an orchestra conductor. And it's almost like he needs to do that,
mm-hmm.
because it's so clear what he's singing. It totally makes sense to me every time I see anything Bad Religion and he's throwing his hands up in the air. I mean, to be that clear about how you feel, that totally makes sense. You have to do that. You have to point,
yep.
because he's like pointing at everything. Yeah, it's amazing.